The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As a young black man, Tulsan R.J. Young grew up with a healthy distrust of guns. But when his white fiancée introduced him to her family, and his future father-in-law's first action was to show him his favorite firearm, R.J. knew he was going to have to learn about guns to relate to his new family. And that began a journey where today, Young is a certified NRA pistol instructor who doesn't carry a gun and keeps it locked away. His journey took him deep into American gun culture, both white and a fast-growing African-American one as well. And in his new book, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns, he describes an escalating cycle of white fear that fuels black fear, and how both feed into American gun culture. The book is in part a memoir and an effort through research and history to better understand this continuing cycle, find ways to curb and alleviate the fear, which for him is deciding not to carry a gun. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. RJ, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich. Longtime fan.
Well, I'm a fan of this new book. It's a really important book that a lot of people need to read. You write that you grew up with little desire to know anything about guns, instilled from your father, and that changed eventually. Why did you have that little desire to know anything about guns, and why did that change?
I met a girl, Rich. a lot of things change.
And a girl with a father who was a gun enthusiast.
Well, it's not just that, right? Because there are many ways to get to know a person, or so you would think, and you want to exhaust those ways in which you have something at your disposal already, which is a strength of yours. Mine is sports. And I write in the book, I had met in person a man who probably was the only person in Oklahoma who could care less about OU football in particular, which I'm an expert on, especially at the time, right? Mm-hmm. At the time, I'm covering OU football. This is very much what I love, sports. And he just is like, eh. You know, what do you think of Bob Stoops? Think he should be fired? I think they all should be fired. And I'm like, well, okay, but and then dud. And, you know, short of his daughter, we didn't have a whole lot in common, and that's not going to work. You know, we got to find something. And it's incumbent upon me, as it many times it often is, to try to find a way to get to know someone, to find something that we can talk about. I really lean in probably more so than I should, because I make myself terribly vulnerable. And in this way, this is ultimately leaning in. This is every time this man talks about guns, he enjoys it.
And upon his first meeting, and we should mention, you're black, the family's white. Hmm. And on first meeting, he shows you, what, a Magnum 44, a huge handgun.
It's called a Taurus Judge. It is self-defense porn. It is a revolver that you can cross-load with 410 shotgun shells and long Colts.
Whoa.
It is for doing a job, right?
Right.
And he was very proud of it.
But he shows this to you at first meeting.
Yeah. Like I might show you, I don't know, this book, you know, if I first meet you. I'm very proud of it, right? It's my trophy. This is my way of saying this is very important to me. This is a way of getting to know me.
But I was having trouble getting through the subtext of you, a young black man dating his white daughter, and his first, you know, impulse is to show you this man cannon.
Well, and see, that's valid, because that is what people immediately come away with.
If I were in your shoes, I might have slipped out of them.
We also have the benefit of hindsight there, right? Yeah. But in that moment, there's no slipping out of that. There's just standing in it. And it's also, I love that scene for all the reasons that other people don't. It is doing what I have asked people to do in this book and what I do every day. Stand there in your uncomfortable shoes, in your anxiety-ridden shoes. Do not move. Take it in, do what you can, ask questions when you can ask questions, but for the most part, stand there, be firm, insist on getting to know someone who might be showing you something that you might otherwise take as dangerous, when really it was, hey, I'm Charles, I'm a good guy, this is important to me, right? Nice to meet you.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about that because you grew up in a culture, your family was like, stay away from guns, nothing good can come from you owning a gun, only bad things.
Well, let's be clear about that, right? Uh-huh. My parents, first, are vets, so they know from firearms, yeah. but we did not have them in the home. And only as I came to be an adult did they become more comfortable with guns and guns in the house. But it wasn't so much that I shouldn't have a gun because I can hurt myself. It was because everybody who has a gun usually has something bad to say about you. Like, I have this scene in the book where my father watches cops, right? Tongue in cheek in the way that he says, I need to know what they're doing. Because in one way, he's giggling like you. In another way,
he's serious.
Well, and why wouldn't he be?
Yeah, of course.
And this is before the epidemic we know now of men who look like me being shot with their hands in the air right. in my hometown, mm-hmm. right? Not just in Sanford, Florida, you know, not just in South Carolina, not just in Chicago and New Orleans, here where I live. And that's real. So that was what I was coached to know about growing up.
You became interested in this family, making connections with who would become your future father-in-law. You say, I have to learn about gun culture. I have to learn about what to do in a gun. And he actually wanted to buy you a gun.
Right. Because at that time, I was fast becoming his second son. And this was something that I had come to understand fathers do for their sons. And many times folks have stories who are gun enthusiasts or who grew up with guns about their father buying them a 22 to go hunt with.
At what point did you think this is something I need to, I mean, the way the book approaches is this is an investigation as much as you're telling your personal story on what fuels gun culture in America. At what point did it say this is something I may want to write about?
Oh, that was really my editor's idea. I had pitched an entirely different book called How to Be a Better White Person, specifically because there were things that I was being asked by friends of mine who are white who felt comfortable coming to me with them. Why is this a big deal? Why is this bad? What am I missing here? And I came away wanting to write some essays about this. And my editor saw this chapter that I had written about leaning in to try to understand and get to know my ex-wife's father. And she said, hey, that there, can that be a book? And at first I was going, can it? And we talked through it. We had extensive conversations about it. And we decided that if it was more about my journey and what I figured out and what I believe, then yeah, that could work.
So he takes you to a gun show, Wanamaker's, right here in Tulsa. What was that experience like?
Harrowing and fulfilling. In the one hand, if I did not have Charles to walk with me, I would not have gone and I would have felt terrible because I am surrounded by a bunch of people who do not look like me. And this is a feeling that is very hard for me to give to folks who don't have melanin in their skin.
Right.
Because they usually walk in rooms where everybody more or less looks like them and believes like them. And I tried to not necessarily give a parallel, but just tell them how I felt. And to walk around and see that many people, also with guns in their hands, bartering with each other, having banter with each other in the way that they do. And this is really an amalgamation of not just Wanamaker's, but going back to Wanamaker's and a few other just local gun shows, because that was another thing that my editor just had a hard time wrapping her head around, is that we have gun shows on a monthly basis. It's just what happens in Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas and so forth, so on. But Confederate flags, I grew up with those in Hattiesburg.
Nazi regalia.
Well, so, but that's kind of the difference, right? I've yeah. come to understand what people are getting at when they say Confederate flag is heritage and not hate, though the heritage they're sticking up for with an enslaved people that look like me, and that's where I would draw a line, but not them. But I also came to believe that we had all agreed Nazis were bad. Everybody. Like, Quentin Tarantino picks out his villains in the way that he does because that's a villain everybody can agree needs to go. Nazis, overseers, slave owners, these dudes. A group of people that tried to kill a pregnant woman in Beatrix Kiddo.
Yeah.
Right, just pure evil. But to see an SS uniform on display and for sale and not see anybody really flinching about that, or just a crowd of people going, hey, take that down, that was off-putting to me. And that was when I really had to answer the question to myself, or ask the question to myself and then answer it. Do people really hate me like that? People I don't know, people who've never met me? What do I say to them? What do you say to them? Where is this conversation being had?
that was one experience. Another was going to a shooting range. Your first experiences with your father-in-law were you were didn't know how to shoot a gun, didn't know how to hold a gun. He said, I'm going to learn how to do this. And so you went to a shooting range. First, I'll practice on your own, then finally with an instructor. And this was another experience where it's like you are sticking out because you're the only person of color walking through the gun range. You're hearing remarks overheard. Some are couched as jokes. Others, I don't think, were really jokes at all. They were racist comments.
Which is par for the course in my experience, just being a 31-year-old black man in my country, right? And I have spent most of my life in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So to say that those things sting in the way that they might other people who have not been encountered with them, not so much, but I'm also going to tell you that this is just part of life. And one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was because even these things that we believe are jokes are so deeply hurtful for reasons that many people don't understand, and more to the point that most people don't want to understand. Nobody wants to be uncomfortable. And I continue to try to tell folks that that's what's most difficult, is being uncomfortable in these circumstances where you are completely out of your depth and you are dependent on the kindness of strangers and people who claim to love you, but sometimes just don't know exactly how and have to learn by making mistakes.
You know, the only thing I can liken it to is if I, as a white person, walked into an all-black church. First of all, I would be welcomed. I know I have been welcomed. But still, there's this comfort level, just being the one person who looks different in the crowd. I've experienced it, and that's the only takeaway as a white person I have on what a person of color goes through in so many situations, and certainly not at a place like a gun show or a shooting range where there are lethal weapons at hand.
Right. And I would take it farther. I've heard that made as a one-to-one
and,
as a parallel.
And it's not a parallel.
Well, but I also want to just take it a step farther, right? Because church is a welcoming place for the most part.
Yes.
Right? And people want you there. And they will go to great lengths to try to make sure
you are
comfortable.
Yes.
I would say this is more like, Rich, we're going to drop you into a Tech N9ne video. That's what we're going to do. Where there are firearms, right? Where not everybody is welcoming to you. Where you have to ask questions about social mores and faux pas. And you have to be extremely alert all the time about what you're doing, where you're standing, standing next to, what you say to who. That is what I would liken it to. Because there is a threat of violence there, but there's also a way to get along. And you have to go up to different people and ask questions that might get you knocked on the head, might get an arm wrapped around you. You don't know. And that's what makes it anxious. And that's why I would take it a step farther.
You said one of your first experiences with your father-in-law was asking, why do you own so many guns? And you've realized that was a faux pas, at least in that family.
That was a bad question to ask. And even now, I feel bad about asking it because I wouldn't ask it to someone else, knowing what I know now, but I didn't. And I didn't get my head bit off. He just left. He just left the room. And I had to ask, you know, my ex-wife, what did I do? What was wrong with this? And that's a difficult thing to encounter. And that's one instance I wrote about, but it happened a lot.
See, I would ask that same question. I've never grown up in a gun culture. I've never owned a gun. I've shot a gun once. I said, okay, I've done that. I'm never going to do it again. I could ask the same question. I understand it's like, you know, asking a rancher how many cattle he owns. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. It's a personal question, I guess.
You're also asking it to what would be your father-in-law. So it's not like you get to put it down and not come back. And that's the other thing. You have to pick up the pieces after that. And that's what made it especially hard, because there's things to do from there. There are pieces to put back together. There's a way of saying, I'm sorry. There's a way of saying, also, I didn't know. And then you have to go forward. And that's something that I don't hear a lot about. Usually you put it down, you leave, right? I asked a bad question. They didn't like the answer. I'm not going to go back into that territory.
My guest today is RJ Young, a writer and a sports commentator, a PhD student, and the author of Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, besides telling your personal story as you end up becoming an NRA instructor, I mean, you really became invested in learning about gun culture and learning how to shoot a firearm properly. You also write a little bit about the history of guns in America in the last 50 years, about the NRA. You write about the huge spike in gun ownership and concealed carry over the past several decades. I think that's often attributed officially to the fear of mass shootings. But you posit that it's a lot of it's based on racial fear. What, in your experience, has led you to think of that being racial fear for the huge spike in gun ownership and concealed carry?
I asked some folks who got concealed carry permits here recently, licenses. I talked with them intimately about their reasons, particularly black folks, where we've seen a large spike in black women being the largest. And they have guns for the same reason that many white folks have handguns, right? Have things that you can pull out of your pocket to...
Or your purse
to end a life, really. That's the only reason that, self-defense is shooting somebody and getting away, right? But many times what folks are focusing on is, I got to shoot that person so that they don't come after me anymore.
Ending the perceived threat.
Perceived threat. And that is why most folks have gotten... Yeah, they feel strongly that there's a person out there who's going to decide to harm them or harm someone they love. And they have taken steps to make sure that that doesn't happen. And that's frightening to me because I don't think that there are enough people who want to hurt each other. I think there are a lot of people who are afraid of being hurt by each other. And that is just a question of comfort.
And you also write a little bit about the NRA and how the focus of the NRA changed about close to 40 years ago, and how it became far more militant about Second Amendment gun rights and know what they would call abridgments to them, and how even just a decade before they were sponsoring gun control laws. But again, there was also a racial ideas at the heart of that.
Well, and that speaks to the political climate every time. When we're trying to sell memberships, because that's what the NRA does, it sells memberships, we are trying to sell you on some sort of fear, a gross fear. And whatever fear you have, that's what we're here to tell you is coming after you. And now we know that it is particularly slanted toward fear of black men. We see that in some of their rhetoric. We see that in how NRA memberships are being sold as to what they protect. And we saw it in their indefensible non-defense of Philando Castile, who, by my count, would have been a perfect candidate.
A poster child for the NRA.
For the NRA, not just as a black man, but just period. You had your license. You told him you were reaching for it. That man was killed and that the NRA was not just slow, but limp in its response can only be taken one way. And it can't be taken that they're looking out for me.
This was the summer of 2016 in Minnesota. Philando Castile was pulled over for a taillight that was out. He said he was a license to conceal carry. He said he was reaching for his driver's license, and the police officer shot him. And then he said he felt threatened by the act of him reaching for his driver's license. And of course, you're referring to the NRA basically going mute for weeks, even as some NRA member said, look, this is exactly the issue the NRA is about. He had concealed carry. He was a law-abiding citizen. He had no felonies or any sort of arrests or convictions, and he was shot.
And what if it was not videotaped? What if his girlfriend did not Facebook Live the event?
Yeah.
What happens then? But also, because she did, the NRA had an ironclad reason to go in on this all the way, to use every bit of its robust lobbying arm to beat this story into submission and probably get the sort of black gun owners that it so craves. But because of that, we have the rise of things like the National African American Gun Association, which I just refer to as NAGA, which believes about guns and about self-defense the way many NRA members do, but such rhetoric that is so racialized puts them off. And that, nah, I don't want to give them any money. Or, hey, I want to get the NRA instructor certificate, but as soon as I get it, I'm canceling my membership because, well, I saw what happened with Philando. I know where you stand with me.
And that's sort of what you did, right?
What I did was try to figure out if gun enthusiasts were right. What I tried to do was, is a good guy with a gun better than a bad guy with a gun? And no was the answer that I came up with. And specifically, hell no, as it relates to me, because I am black. And me having a gun only exacerbates the situation. Rich, if I get pulled over and I have a gun on me, I have a duty to let that officer know I am armed. He might wave it off like some do and just commence with whatever it is he pulled me over for, or he might feel threatened and he might pull a gun on me. If I feel threatened by him pulling a gun on me and I pull my gun and I shoot him, that doesn't end well for me. I go to jail or worse. You know, maybe that officer fires back. But also, if I've a threat and he pulls a gun on him, he shoots me, we have data to show, you know, that's
recent history.
That's within the law. That is lawful. That's a lawful shooting. So either way, it ends badly for me. The most I can do to try to prevent that is to not be armed.
This reminds me of something you wrote on your author statement on the back cover of the book. You said, a quote that says, who's been pulled over by police more often than most white people change their sheets. That's a hard thing for most people to get their head around. And I know it's a reality for many black men in the community, black people in the community, and people of color.
Well, and how much it influences my thinking, right? I'm speaking for myself because black folks are not a monolith. I don't drink if I go out unless I know someone else is driving, right? I have to be 100% sure of where I'm going, why I'm going there. I am constantly on the lookout for cops that are just kind of planted on the side of the road, like they do, usually to pull over speeders. And I had a instance where my mother was in the car with me, and she saw me slow down, and she go, what are you doing? Like, it's 55 through here. I said, there's a cop over there around that corner. No, there's not. And there was. Because I have learned the pattern of what to look for and when they might be there. That influences my thinking. And that goes into a lot of the decisions for why people might make a decision to say, you know, there's this guy that continues to look at me in a bad way. I want a gun because I don't like the way he looks at me. And that's just all of that is influential, right? It all overlaps.
You write, and really the takeaway from this book is you write of this escalating series of cycles of white fear that then fuels black fear, and both feed on this gun culture in our country. Do you have any ideas on how to diminish that?
You have to make yourself uncomfortable, Rich. Like, that's it. I can't do any more than I have done. I wrote the book, one. I have firearms for historical reasons, but they're paperweights at my house. White folks have to ask themselves, what are they willing to give up? What are they willing to sacrifice for the place that we were all told the United States is? Something that was worthwhile for all of us. A dream that was ours. Not yours, not mine. Ours. And black folks in particular haven't really seen that dream come true in the way that many white folks are. With, you can say slavery, but you can also say redlining. And you can say voter registration. And now you can say young black men who can literally be running the other way or walking down the street and end up dead by a firearm. I can only ask white folks to make themselves uncomfortable, to ask questions, to speak up in the spaces where I am not and I will not be. You know, we talked about how I'm an alumnus of the University of Tulsa, but that is also to know that many of my peers, where we were athletes, that's what we did. A lot of the folks that I went to class with were white. And these conversations we would have, right? But we would have them in a vacuum of a dorm room or at the CAF. What happens when you leave this place and you get married and you have a job and you're paying taxes and you look around and you say, where are my taxes going? Are they going to make sure that people are allowed to live as they choose, or are they going to make sure that I am more comfortable? And many people choose themselves over everyone else.
You write in the book, it says it's about standing up saying something when you hear something, places that you wouldn't be, where things are said, when opinions are expressed, and you have to be brave and stand up for that. That's the only way you stop this cycle of fear, right?
Yes, and be brave and stopping it knowing that you're probably going to lose something.
Explain that.
To be brave and to stand up in a room full of your peers and your friends is also to invite their ear, is to invite their irritation, their annoyance, and ultimately, whether or not you're still friends with that person. And that's happened to me. I have lost friends and people that I have called family because of how I feel about this book and about race in America. It's not territory that you can walk into without someone extracting a pound of flesh from you. And that's where I continue to say it's about what are you willing to lose? What are you willing to give up? It's the same sort of thinking that I give money to KWGS Public Radio, but am I really going to go to bat for this young black child that I don't even know? Parents I don't know, don't have a connection to, I see him being picked on. Yeah, and there are stories where people get beat up for that. We have those. That's a reality. And that's why I really thought this book was important and why I make myself so vulnerable in it, because that's also part of the project. This is me. This is the playbook that I had. This is the way that I succeeded. This is the way that I failed. Perhaps you'll read it and you'll apply something from it, anything at all, to making the world in the kind of place that we were all told it would be.
You don't carry a gun today. You own guns, but you don't carry it. Do you have any regrets about this whole experience of that you write about in the book?
I don't have any regrets about how I came to these conclusions. I regret hurting feelings, getting my own feelings hurt. Nobody wants to feel pain. And to take away the pain would be to not write the book. But pain is also a part of life, and we also don't really get to come up with answers to all of our questions. So yes and no is the answer to your question. But also, I have this very hard won ground that I stand on when someone tells me I have a gun. I say, okay, I am certified by the NRA to teach pistol instruction. That's how good I am. I don't carry a gun. So if I don't, why do you? And that's a different sort of conversation. And this is a large price to pay to have that conversation with that standing. But I have it now. So I'm going to use it.
R.J. Young, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
R.J. Young is a writer, a sports commentator, and a PhD student at OSU, and the author of Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.